You're listening to New Voices, a production of the Extending New Narratives in the History of Philosophy project.
This podcast is sponsored by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada and partner institutions.
I'm Olivia Branscombe.
And I'm Haley Brennan.
In this episode, I talk to Dwight K. Lewis, Jr., assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy at the University of Minnesota. Dwight and I talk about the life and work of the philosopher Anton Wilhelm Amo, including his claims about different kinds of prejudice and using justice as a tool and paradigm of reasoning. We also talk about the different contexts for political resistance and the importance of varied mediums for philosophy.
Yes, so I'm Dwight K. Lewis, Jr. I am an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota. I work on maybe too many things, the history of philosophy, particularly the early modern period. And then inside of that, I work on marginalized figures in the history of philosophy, particularly Anton Wilhelm Amo. I work on what I like to call philosophy of difference. So I work on race, sex, gender, politics, power. I just taught a course on Fanon, Butler, and Baldwin, which is super, super fun. I have a center here at the university called the Center for Canon Expansion and Change, which I co-direct with Jessica Gordon Roth and Bennett McNulty. And I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you here. So let's start off with talking a little bit about Amo and your work on Amo. So how did you start working on Amo? How did you get interested in it? And how did you start?
So a little bit about Amo. Amo is this Black figure who ends up in Germany in the early 18th century, defends a dissertation in 1734, and then teaches at some German universities afterwards. Which is, you know, quite unbelievable, especially when we're talking about 1734, we're talking about the height of the slave trade. This is just a wild time for him to be doing what he's doing. So I went to the University of South Florida, where Roger Arieff is at, and fell in love with the modern period right away. I actually went there and I was going to work on the Third Republic of France, where the Fanon and all that comes into play. And I got there and bumped into Arieff. I took a course with him on Montaigne and just fell in love with Montaigne. And I did religion in my undergrad. And so it was super easy to then step into the modern period. So I took a bunch of courses with Arieff, Doug Jessiff on the early modern time period. And really, I was in those courses, and there were just no figures that looked like me in those courses. And so I just decided that I was going to like try to find something or someone. And I was actually in class with Arieff. I was like, every day I would come to Arieff and be like, well, where are the Black? I know you maybe have said there was this Black figure, like, help me out here. And he was like, gave me the name Amo, and that's it. And then I just went to the internet.
That was going to be my next question. So you heard the name Amo. You were not being taught about Amo.
No.
So you gave it a name. You went to the internet. What happened after that?
Oh, the internet exploded. There really was not much, but there was a point where I had, I just went to the internet. I'm typing away, trying to find stuff. I, of course, find Justin Smith's website. I find a couple other things, and then I'm trying to get all his works. And there was a point where I had every English translation of his work in the U.S. in my office as a grad student. And I was like kind of blown. I was like, damn, I could really do something with this. And then I found Justin's book, Nature, Human Nature, and Human Difference. In chapter 8 of that, he talks about Amo. The whole chapter is on Amo. And I just emailed Justin and I was like, hey, I disagree with you on these things about what you're saying about Amo. And he like emailed me back. And then I actually flew over to Paris to meet Justin and spent some time with Justin and then continued to just like Google to be serious. I have found quite a bit of sources by using Google, like news sources.
Yeah.
Like I found at least five in the last like 3 or 4 years from Google, which, you know, shout out Google.
I was going to say, what your high school teachers told you is wrong, everybody. Wikipedia is a great resource for. Yeah. But okay. So you read, so you started Googling from a place of not knowing anything about MO or, yeah.
I knew MO, three letters. That's what I knew.
So what sort of marked your disagreement, or were you, by the time you had disagreements with Jesse Smith's book and the chapter on MO, had you read some of the primary sources? Were the disagreements about sort of the textual details of MO's work, or were the disagreements just about the way he presented the figure?
I think that I am someone that, like, I am disagreeable to some extent. You know, I mean, I am a philosopher, but one of the things that I leaned on, and, you know, this is the thing, all respect to Justin for grinding in the way that he's done to bring attention to MO, to put out this chapter for him and Stephen Menz to write this book in, that came out in 2020, which has translations, English translations of MO's dissertation and disputation afterward. The title of the dissertation is On the Apathy of the Human Mind. And then the other one is A Distinct Idea of Those Things Concerning That Are Concerned or like tied to the mind or the body. So what are those things that are tied to either one of those things? Great works. And they did a great job translating it. The introduction is sound. But one thing when I went to Justin, especially about his chapter eight in Nature, Human Nature, and Human Difference, was the ways that, like, this book was not about MO, and the ways that MO, in relationship to especially race history, is just being thrown into this book when it's not actually about him, it's about race. And so I was a little concerned about that. There were other critiques, but Justin took them head on. He didn't hesitate at all. We had great conversation about it. I was really pumped. But mostly it was about the ways that MO was being used in the text. That, like, what we needed is a text that forefronted MO. And then he heard that and, you know, put it out.
So in your own work, how do you aim to present MO? Or how do you think that MO should be presented?
It's a good question. Because, you know, we can't interpret MO in a vacuum, right? Texts live and breathe out of an environment. They come... like, that person is not isolated from the world. And so one of the things that I really think that is paramount in relationship to doing MO scholarship is the importance of his biography, also in relationship to his philosophy, but holding these two things as just as important as one another. And I think that there are ways that someone like Justin is not going to see the things that I'm going to see in the biography, especially. There are ways that, like, for me, I'm really working on some of the ways that he is being marginalized, even in relationship to his biography. So then we can then, like, have a more robust understanding of race during the time period. And I'll give one example. There is a point where he's trying, all his benefactors have died. So the Dukes of Wolfenbuttel had all passed away by 1735. And so MO is really on his own at this point. And mm-hmm. We're talking about these dukes were very wealthy. The Duke Anton Ulrich had, like, sold off all of his granddaughters to, like, very powerful people. So Peter the Great's son, the Holy Roman Empire's son that was going to be the next emperor. He was just also connected with Louis the 14th and actually backed Louis the 14th over his family at one point in the war. And so this guy was just, like, very powerful. I've read, like, notes that someone wrote from Germany to someone in the UK talking about how powerful he was. So MO was able to live in a way that not a lot of Black figures could live, but also not a lot of white figures were even able to live during the time period because of the power that this family had. But going back to this experience, after they all passed away, he's trying to find somewhere to work. And so he sends a letter to the University of Jena, and the faculty are, like, trying to figure out if they're going to allow him to come work. And a couple of them are like, well, we don't care. And there's others that are like, no, we need him to do these particular things. And the rector comes along and he's like, if this was any of you, we would not hesitate to make this happen. right? Someone that is not attuned to existing in the world in a way like this may not be able to see that as something that's, you know, race-based. But for me, I hear that, and this rector is like, yo, if this guy was not Black, none of y'all would hesitate to being like, yeah, he should come here and teach. But I'm just proud of that the rector for standing up.
Can you speak a bit more about how Amo got to that position in the first place? So, like, his relationship with this Duke and how his perception and reception was influenced by this powerful backer.
Yeah, I think that is actually that's the power that he's given. That he, right, so at this time, especially in Germany, what we have, and all over, right, we can actually look all over Europe. Black figures are often used as like tokens of wealth or ways to show how much power and privilege you really have. And then that would elevate in relationship to what your Moor or your Black was able to do, right? And so someone like a Mo would have been brought out at dinner all the time and like, look at what we have. Like, he would have been a part of everything just because they were trying to show off how great they really were. And we see this with Peter the Great. Peter the Great does the same thing with Abraham Ganebold. And then we see the same thing with Louis XIV, who brings over this prince and actually allows the prince to be a part of his cavalry, right? We see pictures of Peter the Great's sister-in-law and his daughters with their Moors, painted images, beautiful images, right? And so these people, oftentimes, someone like Amo is just seen as something that's like elevating your status, right? And we see this in almost everything that's written about Amo that's not written by him, right? It's like they're always bringing up the Dukes. They're always bringing up the power of the Dukes, checking on the health of the Dukes. When we talk about Amo and the privileges that he had, I think even afterwards, he's still going to have a little bit of those privileges too. And I think that's what we hear from the rector, is the rector like, this is a powerful family, like, and also, like, these granddaughters are still placed in very powerful positions. And so there's a way that, like, Amo, even in the death of the Dukes, it still has some type of prestige, right, based on who he was acquired by.
So it sounds, at least to me, what you're saying is that a lot of the work of understanding Amo as a philosopher and as a historical figure is in pulling apart the nuances of class and race and power.
Yeah.
And in recognizing when Amo is being responded to along one dimension versus when he's being responded to along another. Exactly. And when those dimensions come apart, when they intersect.
Yeah. Sometimes I like to think about it, you know, in the ways that some Black study figures today are thinking about race, right? In this crawl space at the intersection between like social death and social life. And what I want to say is that Amo has a lot of social death based on Blackness, but he gets a bunch of social life from the social capital of the Dukes. And so he's in a precarious crawl space. He's in a crawl space that, like, if he doesn't play the game that, like, they want him to play, then he's going to be in a very fraught position. And so he's in this, like, space where the only way that he's going to, like, stay alive to some extent, and this is why I also think Amo is a revolutionary, while, like, he's not really running out here doing philosophy of race, or, like, what we see is someone who exists in a space that was trying to annihilate him in relationship to something like social death. Or not even just social, right? We want to talk about, this is the height of the Black Atlantic, right? Like, literally trying to kill him. And so we're just like, he is able, I just can't, like, I'm already the only tenure track Black philosopher in my state. Can't imagine if I was that in the world. Like,
right.
And how isolated that would be, what I would have to do. And how I'd have to bend and bow, because I'm already bending and bowing like crazy now still. And I'm in like a fairly privileged position and I'm still doing it. So I can't imagine being in that marginalized of a position and like dealing with that space. Can't imagine.
So just connecting a couple of the things you just said, it sounds like a big part of what draws you to Amo and what continues to sustain your work on him is a sense of connection to him as a person, and then, you know, a set of shared experiences, even though they are, you know, shared across centuries. So along those lines, I was wondering if Amo himself ever wrote, either personally or philosophically, about these experiences, being the only Black, the only African person pursuing a degree at the university at that time.
Yeah. So I am going to get to that question, but I want to, for a second, bring up part of the reason why Amo is so essential. And I'm actually going to use my nieces as an example. So, I have two beautiful nieces. I have five nieces and a nephew. They are lovely, but two of my nieces, my sister had, and she called me and told me about this conversation. Then I asked her to text it to me. So I want to read a little bit of this conversation with my sister. So the younger one, she's four, Ember. She says, "My friend Riley has white skin. I want skin like hers." And then my sister is like, "Well, Ember, you can think her skin is beautiful and your skin can be beautiful too. You both have beautiful skin." And then Ember, this four-year-old, is like, "No, I want to be like my friends." And then Willow, she's six. She comes in and she's like, "That's why I'm happy that I have Riley in my class, since she is brown too, so I don't have to be brown all by myself." Right? And it's like, these are the reasons why, at least one of the reasons why, like, I'm so tied to doing this work. And I'm like trying not to be emotional right now, but she doesn't also have to be the only one seeing herself in history too, right? She doesn't have to like imagine anymore, right? The like invisible has become like visible, right? And I think it's really like, for me, we see this, the importance of it just in a classroom. Now when history is whitewashed, the importance of that also. But I went to undergrad and didn't read any Black folks. So I went to Wheaton College in Chicago, and I did theological studies, and then I dabbled in like history of the church, but I didn't read any black figures in undergrad. It's an isolating experience. And so like by the time I was like a junior or senior, I just stopped reading for class, and I would do whatever I wanted to read, and I would turn in papers. And I was like, I'm really happy that I was at like a private liberal arts where like people were willing to read my stuff, and it was, you know, eight people in my classes, and they got what I was doing. But I was like, I need to like not be just doing the project that you've placed in front of me, which is like isolating myself. I think it takes a lot to be that type of person. I think that I'm like, you know, people talk about someone being a dog in like sports, you know, and I feel like I'm a little bit of a, like, I'm that person that it's like, no, fuck that. I don't want it. It was, and it's still, it's still hard to this day. It's, a lot of us are working on this stuff still, but the goal is to change. You know, I got a big goal, but the goal is to change history so that other people can see themselves in history. You know, over the past 5 years, you know, the literature, the people that we found, the people that we're calling philosophers, has just blown up. Early modern, you've got Amo, you've got Phyllis Wheatley, you've got Janora Lee, you've got all of these Black figures that are just popping up that we're starting to write about, Jacobus Capitan. It's just so many figures. And so it's we're an exciting place in history, and at least early modern philosophy, in relationship to black figures. But back to the original question, Amo, does he have anything to say about race or anything like that? So in 1729, Amo was at, so he started there in 1727 at the University of Halle, and then defends a disputation in 1729 on the rights of Moors in Europe. And we don't have that. We don't know where it's at. A lot of people want to say that it was never printed. You know, I am of a different opinion, that it has been lost to time, but hopefully we'll find it at some point. And the only part of the reason I'm saying this is because in the last 2 years, I found a source from 1731 that was like, oh, like this person just did this in Halle, Amo just did this in Halle, and we should be looking for works to be like coming out, like prints to be coming out. And we never see it. So, and the next thing that we see printed is in 1734. So it's wild. I don't know, 3 years later, we're seeing prints. I would expect faster than that, especially it seemed like he already had something. But on the rights of Moors in Europe, we don't have it. All we have is what the Halle Weekly newsletter writes. So they put a little summary. And in the summary, it says, and I've got a little piece of paper here. I'm going to read it. Not the whole summary, but one little part. It says that the legal faculty gave Amo this disputation so that the argument of the disputation would be appropriate to his situation, end quote. And I hear that. And what it reveals to me is that legal scholars understood and knew the complications of African freedom and slavery. Furthermore, that there were these debates going on in the early modern time period. Of course, you know, someone like me, of course, wishes it would have gone the other way. But what we see here is a Black experience being forced on Amo. And the reason I'm saying this is because Amo never writes about any of this stuff. Like, never about race at all. But of course, disputation topics are given to students at this time in Germany. But that it says particularly here that so it would be appropriate to his situation, to me, is like the West being like, we see that you're Black, and we're going to give you something that like pushes you to work on this Blackness also. But we don't see him ever writing about any of this stuff ever again, ever again. He's only doing early modern philosophy, not on slavery, not on race, not on any of this stuff ever again. And so I'm intrigued. I'm intrigued by this like Black experience or this Africana experience, Africana philosophical experience being forced on Amo, and the ways that like it seems to be the case that like Amo not running from this, but like not stepping into this puddle either,
yeah,
because he knows how hot it is. And he actually leaves Halle right after this. Doesn't even get his degrees. He gets his degree at the new university, University of Wittenberg, when he moves, which is just mind-blowing. I'm like, it's an intriguing situation. And so I'm just intrigued to like more about this. But this is the only like experience that we have of him talking about these type of issues.
Do you wish that he had written more? Or at least we had preserved his writings on his personal experiences?
Yes, I do wish there were more. I mean, if we found this, I would cry. I shouldn't be the one that finds it because there's going to be tears on the air. So I just am like, I shouldn't find it. I like, yes, yes, and yes. But Black is multiplicitous. There are many of ways that it shows up. And to silo it to one or two things is a tragedy. And so Amo is showing up exactly the type and the ways that his Blackness should and could show up at the time. And I'm proud of him. I love this dead person. I talk about this in relationship to resistance all the time in my other course, especially in relationship to colonialism or power. You know, you've got to resist in the ways that you can resist. Not everyone can be a Dwight. Like, not everyone can like run through walls and try to burn shit down and try to like, also like, as we're burning shit down, be like, let's take what's good and not burn that down too and build from there. How do we not everyone can do that. My mom was a single mother. Like, there was no way that she was going to be able to like do what she does and get like help get me to where I'm at if she would have been out fighting in the ways that I'm fighting. And so I think that we need to be okay with people showing up the way that they can show up to resist. Amo is resisting the way that he has to, and I'm okay with Amo. Like, I'm proud, not just okay, I'm proud of the way that Amo has shown up. And it's hard. It's hard, yeah. It's hard because, of course, you want someone that's like, you want like a Fanon, you want like a Baldwin, you want like a Malcolm X, and it's like, you want a Audre Lorde, you want like a bell hooks. Everyone can't be that. We need we need people like my sister, April, who's just like trying to like love on her daughters, these beautiful Black brown babies, and tell them that they're valuable in the world. Like, we need all of that. And so I'm like, I'm proud of the way that Amo shows up. Even if he didn't write this MA thesis, I would still be working on him. I talk about this stuff in the classroom, though. Like, there's people, we've had long conversations about people like Denisha Carter in my class, Black woman who's like, you know, really progressive on TikTok and has a huge following. Yeah, I think these are the ways that we can really connect some of the things that we're doing in the classroom with the world, even if it's early modern. Gournay is doing what Gournay's doing, and like Denisha Carter's doing what Denisha Carter's doing, and they're both doing it in like revolutionary ways, and I love it. I love it.
So that's sort of a perfect transition point to come back to a point you mentioned at the very start, which is that you are interested in the relationship between biography and philosophy. And I'll ask this question particularly about Amo, just for the sake of our focus, but please feel free to extend it to a question, sort of a general question about approach or mindset. Well, what does it mean to you to connect biography and philosophy, either, like I said, with specific examples from Amo, or as a general claim about the relation between the way someone lives their life and the ideas they produce and advocate?
So I did a lot of work in grad school, particularly trying to be as accurate as I could in relationship to Amo's biography in the West. And so I got like I've got like every piece of source material on this stupid computer. Great, great stuff. Able to build a biography, a narrative of his story. But one of the ways that I'm just trying to do philosophy a little different is that I just didn't take that to be enough. And so when I was at Emory in the James Weldon Johnson Institute, they funded me to go, and actually MAP funded me to go to Ghana, because what I wanted to do, where Mo is from, I wanted to go and look for oral narratives. And so because I wanted to, I was like, all right, so we've got this Western story. What's the African story? What is there an African story?
A story of Amo's life.
Of Amo's life, yeah. And so I spent a week out there. Like, I never went to Accra. I never went to the capital. I was like in the back of pickup trucks, going up and down the coast, paying off a bunch of cops. They knew that I was, from the second they saw me, they knew that I was not from there. Yeah, so we're driving up and down the coast, and I'm walking through villages just trying to like ask people, do they know Amo? Have they ever heard of this old man? Like trying to like, is there an old man that anyone has heard about that was a sage or a lot, like a week doing this, and found nothing. But I found a lot of people with the last name, Amo. Amo's a super popular name in Ghana, and was at the time also, there's a really famous general, Amo Tekki, actually during the 18th century that like fought against the Dutch and the Germans. Very popular name. But I think I just didn't spend enough time. There was one guy that everyone was like, this guy would know, also named Amo. And he were like, he's off somewhere, and he's going to be gone for like 3 or 4 days. So you could just like wait for him. And I was like, I want to do that. But it's like, this is just a different life where they're like, who knows? Like, you just got to sit and wait for him to come back. And it's like, I need Western weight and money.
Yeah.
And so I did end up filming a lot, learned a lot in that experience. At the University of Ghana, when I would go there, I talked to quite a bit of scholars there about why Amo wasn't being taught in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And they, it's just such a wild response. But they were like, until there's an Oxford handbook, or until there's an Oxford book on Amo, we can't be teaching Amo. And pretty much what I'm hearing from this is that, right, we're a colonized nation, right? The only way that the ways that we move up in the world, the ways that like we're seen as valuable, is when we do things in relationship to the West. And so if the colonizer hasn't valued this thing, then we can't value it. And it just broke my heart. It broke my heart because it's like, you can't value your own people unless the colonizer values your own people to be able to make sure that you can move forward in the world. It broke my heart. But now we've got an Oxford book. We've got a volume 2 coming out, just met, and we had a group of scholars. We just were there. Justice Smith was there, Julia Walls, Julia Genordi. And we are trying to plan this second edition that's going to be student friendly. And then we were going to do an edited volume. I think we're leaning towards a special issue of a journal to go along with that, just to give people resources to be able to teach a Mo. So the real shtick of this edition is to have the translations, to have the bio, and then to have, you know, this section divided in text and context, and then areas underneath that, and just give 5 or 6 pages, and then in the edited volume, we're gonna have full articles that then can be applied to those few sections. And the goal is then to get this edition out there, to make it where students can read a bio, 5 or 6 pages, a translation. And then, like, if the professor wants to know more, if they want to lead their students to more, we've got this edited volume or special series, special issue, to really, like, be able to have something to take into the classroom instead of being, hopefully people are not lost when teaching a Mo anymore.
It's a story that really highlights the importance of doing work on a Mo, in particular someone like a Mo, not just, you know, here at home and not just for our own purposes or our own scholarship, but the sort of wide reach of teaching possibilities it has.
And that's really my goal for a Mo is, like, you know, I am a, like, I might as well put as a AOS, like, I'm critiquing the discipline. Like, I'm really trying to push this discipline to step fully into itself, to do the things that it really can do in the ways that, and I know I'm bringing it all the way back to your first question, but in the ways that I think that a Mo does it, even without saying that he's doing it explicitly. So for a Mo, when we talk about philosophy, or we talk about even conceptualizing ideas, we can't do that without also talking about justice. He wants justice in relationship to even conceptualizing an idea, because he thinks that ideas can be unjust, right? And so it's like little things like this that are like wild.
Yeah, I was gonna say, can you tell me a little bit more about that? Ideas can be unjust.
Yeah. So I think what a Mo would say is something like, and Lauren Forbes is also taught, has a paper on prejudice in relationship to a Mo. I think it's prejudice in relationship to a Mo and Gurney. But really the focus is like trying to come up with conceptual ideas that do not hold prejudice, in particular types of prejudice, whether it's prejudice from the new, prejudice of the old, prejudice in relationship to other things. He's really trying to push us to think about when we are doing philosophy that, like, we can actually, through logic, derive something that is not good, right? And so how do I make sure that I'm deriving things that are actually good in the world or just in the world? And so a lot of what we see, a fair amount of what we see in The Logic, which is his textbook that he writes, published in 1738, The Art of Soberly and Accurately Philosophizing. But this is the whole point, is that he's trying to be, you know, accurate and do it in a particular way that is like sober, that is not like beating people up, right? He's like, how do I give someone the tools to be able to be a philosopher in a way that's like loves accuracy, but also loves justice, right? And he's gonna, like, of course, go through, like, he's got a lot of scholastic background. And so he's gonna go through this like normative scholastic thing, definition, descriptions, limitations, you know, proofs, things like this. But he's doing it with like this eye for things that are pushing out things that are lead to or that are created from prejudice. For him, when he's talking about prejudice, he talks about it in so many different ways.
So I'm gonna start there. Tell me about the different ways he talks about prejudice, because we did spend a little bit of time talking about how Mo doesn't, you know, sort of rejects racial discussion and is forced on him, but then is now having multiple kinds of prejudice, which sort of naturally lends itself to.
So I will say this, it doesn't, like, it's not explicit that he's bringing up racial prejudice in this.
Yeah.
He's talking about, like, he brings up prejudice in relationship to a tradition. So, like, holding yourself too strongly to a tradition or being prejudiced about a tradition, right? I think these are, like, little things that we would see, like, an early, like, this is very early modern. Also, being prejudiced because you don't know enough, right? I think oftentimes people will hold some type of prejudice because they have not been educated in a particular thing. And I will give an example. So either the majority of Black people are liars or racism exists. Or what you're telling me is that you know something more about being racially profiled in the world than Black people do. Either the majority of women are liars or sexism exists. or what you're telling me is you know more about what it's like to be a woman in the world than women do, right? And I think Amo might hold to the same claim that he's like, yo, based on what you know, you can actually hold prejudice about other people or other things or other concepts, right? And so my own knowledge can cause prejudice, what I know. And we can connect it, this with someone like Jose Medina in the Epistemology of Resistance, who talks about, you know, those marginalized people having particular characteristics and those people that privilege having particular characteristics. And privileged, right, is oftentimes tied to arrogance and ignorance. And I think this really, at some point, I do want to write this paper of the ways that I see this connecting to Amo, the ways that he's talking about not knowing and how not knowing can lead to prejudice also.
So to sum up a bit, if I can, just thinking about the relationship between biography and philosophy, I just think, to me, this example highlights that relation so nicely, both in the ways Amo is thinking about justice and about prejudice, and in the way that you know, given your set of experiences, find these ideas in Amo, you know, like the layers of it, right? That you sought out Amo as a figure of study, and that you can then bring, you know, out of his writings these ideas that, you know, that are so relevant and fresh and still in contemporary philosophical discussion. You know, I think it just evidences the point so nicely and so clearly that our philosophical claims, you know, are influenced by our life experience, whether it was in the early modern period or today looking back at the early modern period.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's like, I think it even, like, so many of us are hiding anyways. Like, I will give an example of myself in relationship to working like Amo may have worked, but I'm doing this with the Center for Canon Expansion, which I talked about earlier, Center for Canon Expansion and Change. Like, us as a group, one of the things is that, like, I had spent a long time, like, yelling. And I just got tired of, like, yelling. And so I just spent a long time thinking about what I could do instead of yelling. And the center is what came to my mind. Because what I could then do is, like, bring in 20 scholars a year and teach them how to teach to an inclusive group. Also teach them how to teach an inclusive group and then send them home. And then they'll be teaching these early modern classes for 20, 30 years. And the impact that that has is just like ripple effects. And if we can do that for 20 years, 30 years, you know, at that point, we've just, you know, shifted the early modern time period in the ways that it's being taught without even having to yell. And so these are the ways that I'm like, Amo has enhanced the ways that I'm like actually responding to social justice today, because I'm now way more trying to build coalitions and trying to, even if I disagree with someone, it's fine to disagree and still like respect and love what they're doing in the world. I think that better work is being done today than what I was doing 5 years ago in relationship to like shifting change in the discipline.
You what now discussed, just as you mentioned, then discussed the Center for Canon Expansion and Change. Are there any more initiatives that you are participating in? So, I mean, you mentioned, I guess, several of her thinking about changing the discipline, right? You're part of an Oxford handbook, part of multiple Oxford handbooks on Amo. You set up the Center for Canon Expansion and Change. You host a summer school, right? Every year. Does the center, are there other operations at the center, or are there other things that you are doing that are working towards changing the discipline?
So with the center, so what we're doing is, just like you said, a 1 week summer school where we spend the first half of the week just dealing with teaching. Like we're not even really trying to think about the syllabus yet. We spend the first 2 days is really an evaluation of yourself. We're trying to get you to find out who you are. Because, you know, the research shows, and I believe that, like, when you are fully invested in a classroom because you like what you're doing, like, the students react better, meaning the students are more invested also. And so we've got to find what you love, what you value, and then we've got to find a way to put that into your course objectives and do this backwards design of, like, how do we then take this and put this in your course objectives and apply this to your course? And so, like, we have people that come in and they're like, I'm really for the arguments, right? And so how do I take the arguments and still find a way to talk about race and gender and sex if we can, right? Or the slave trade or all types of things. How do I make it about the argument and still do that? For me, mine is my main objective is always for my students to be able to create and manage their own realities. And so my focus is always going to be, no matter what I'm teaching, if I'm teaching early modern, how is this aiding my students in creating and managing their own realities? I like still present the same ideas. All I'm doing is being like, how can I come up with activities, assignments that then implore them to apply this to their own lives? And I will answer your other question too. You were asking me about other initiatives. So I am working with Hackett right now on a kind of like a contextual scholar-friendly emotex, which is really going to, the goal of this is to put everything in there in context so that people can then use this to create more scholarship, right? And so I'm going to have, you know, a bunch of translations in there, but I'm also going to have all of his biographical stuff translated too. And then I am also working on an analytic anthology on justice, inclusion, stuff like this. And so what we're doing, and this is with Wiley Blackwell, me and Matt Levine are putting together an anthology. It's going to have like six sections, like philosophy of mind, epistemology, and the rest. And we take some seminal texts, and then we're going to have little summaries for each. We are adding two or three texts that are about social political stuff that relates to those seminal analytic texts to really get people thinking outside of the box in relationship to analytic philosophy. And then I'm also weirdly, so we have here the Minnesota Institute of Art, which is a museum, the MIA. So this project is not fully green lighted, but it's like yellow green that me and a curator named Dennis, who's at the MIA, are actually working on an exhibit that's going to take up three rooms in the MIA. Where what we're doing is looking at Black texts. And then we're trying to take these like text, we're trying to take like the textual images and find visual images to like place above them to like allow us to think about these texts and bring us back to these texts, to the people that have written them, but also to say that texts don't have to be dead, right? That like, you don't have to go home and read Invisible Man. Like come, you're a single mother, you got three kids, like come to the MIA and look at these images and enjoy this. Try to grab something about Invisible Man, even though you don't have the time to read it, right? And so how do we do that? So I'm working on this also. I'm working on a project on Octavia Butler too. I am looking at masculinity in Butler, especially in relationship to Kindred, for sure. But I think, like, I don't know what else I'm working on, but those are the major things.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a lot of projects and a lot of varied projects, and to kind of continue a thread that has popped up time and time again throughout our conversation, right? That different mediums of access, different perspectives of access, you know, all of these things are not only important to you, I don't know, to put words into your mouth, but also to philosophy and to the way we transmit philosophical ideas in the world.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much for having me. This has been so much fun.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you so, so much. Awesome. This has been wonderful. Great conversation.
Thank you for listening to New Voices. Production of the podcast is funded by the Social Science and Humanities Research Council of Canada as part of the Extending New Narratives in the History of Philosophy project. The music you hear is 17th century female composer Elizabeth Claude Jacquet de la Guerre's Sonata No. 2 in D major, performed on the violin by Pizzeria Armonici. For more information about the project and for future episodes, please visit our website, newnarrativesinphilosophy.net.
New Voices is a continuation of the New Narratives in the History of Philosophy podcast. You can also find past episodes under that name in all the same places.
We look forward to discussing all these new figures and ideas with you.